today on Building the Open Metaverse.
So I think that changing things in the virtual world thing is significant. You know, it's nice to have the, well, we went to the cool, music event or whatever, or the party, and we met up, and that's fine to have the social spaces and so on. But I think that virtual thing where you're actually building, something, and that it has some kind of permanence in a sense, there's really something strong about that. There's something really compelling about that.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our show, Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insights on how the community is building the metaverse together. I'm Patrick Cozy from Cesium. Our co-host is Mark Petit from Epic Games. He is out this week, but he's with us in spirit. Today, we have a very special guest. It's going to be a real treat. With us today is Eric Haynes, Distinguished Engineer at NVIDIA. Eric, how's it going?
Oh, great.
So, Eric, you've done many things in the computer graphics community over your career thus far. A few that I really appreciate, the 4 editions of the real-time rendering book as co-author. I think I learned as much from your books that I did in grad school, and I learned a lot in grad school about computer graphics. You've done so much else to support the community. Your Udacity course for interactive 3D graphics, I think, reached so many folks. Ray Tracing News, I remember reading many of those articles and implemented a few of them as well. And more recently, Ray Tracing Gems, everything you've done for i3D conference. And then, thinking of Metaverse, so with Minecraft, what you did with Mineways for 3D export to do 3D printing or to publish out to Sketchfab. And then your work now at NVIDIA with Omniverse. So I could go on and on, but I we'd love to hear, your journey to the Metaverse from your perspective.
Yeah, it's funny because in preparation for this podcast, I have been sort of thinking about what, my history, as it were. And I started out in high school in 1974 or something. There was a PDP-11 computer with, all of 4K. It had little blinking lights on the front. You could toggle in your instructions that way. But there was now bad things are happening on my screen. Discord, I forgot to turn off Discord. Right, you had blinking lights, you had all 4K memory, you would load up a compiler, or not an interpreter for BASIC or whatever, and that'd be 3 of your 4K. You had a little teletype for your output. I mean, it was nothing. But nonetheless, you could, you could do kind of cool stuff. You could play games. You could, if you sent the right kinds of loops to your computer, you can make noises coming out of your transistor radio, could pick it up, and just, crazy things like that. Then I got to use the computer that used the school computer, the data processing one that I got to use, Fortran, and I had, punch cards and all that kind of junk, right? So, it's basically old paper tape punch cards kind of day. But what was interesting to me was that back then, even then, I sort of had this urge to share, which was just, I translated a bunch of these BASIC games written in the language BASIC to Fortran. And so I wrote a letter to the People's Computer Company newspaper, which was just a, enthusiast kind of newspaper saying, hey, I've done this translation, and here's my address. If you want them, I'll send you some listings. And I didn't think I'd get any responses, but I got about 50 responses of people going, hey, send me listings. And so I still remember, printing out a whole bunch of these and sitting on the floor and with a friend and cutting them out and putting them in envelopes, and sending them off with postage and all this. And it's just such a, like you think about that now, and it's like, wow, that's so crazy. We used email. We had to go to the library if you wanted to look up a paper. There's just all the stuff that, I remember the internet. I remember, there's sort of, you could put things on Usenet and so on in the 80s, and that was cool. And then seeing, oh my gosh, the web, the sort of a web browser kind of thing in the 90s, that was just another miracle. And I mean, that's just been great sort of about, things in general. So obviously, message, information sharing has just been getting easier and easier. And that's all been fine. But also what's great is just to see how graphics has kind of evolved. I mean, really graphics, I think, in college, I sort of started with punch cards. And by the end of college, at the graphics lab at the university I was at, Rensselaer Polytechnic, they had this networked system of sort of vector displays, you know, which were interactive speed vector displays. And of course, I didn't use them for any useful work, and nor did my friends. What we did was one guy had invented this game called Tank War. And of course, you know, we played the living daylights out of that. And, you know, utterly addictive. And you're like, oh, my gosh, you know, this is this glimpse of the future that, you know, you, this interactive thing, you know, in 1980. You know, wow, if we can make this happen, this is just incredible. Anyway, so, yeah, so after I graduated in 80, I worked for a satellite launch company, actually, for a few years, RCA Astroelectronics in Princeton, New Jersey. And that was fun, but I, due to my sort of undergrad years, I had met this guy named Al Barr, who's at Caltech now, and he's one of these graphics pioneer types. And I just remember visiting him in Harvard Square in, like, 1982, sitting on his, you know, unfurnished apartment, basically sitting on the floor, looking at this thing called SIGGRAPH and looking at the back cover of that and going, wow, what the heck, you know, all these cool things are going on. I got to get into that. So he told me the universities to apply to, and I got into Cornell, and I went to Cornell and did that for a few years. And that's where I learned about ray tracing and did some ray tracing research there. I was there at the time. I can't say I had any part of it, but I was there at the time the Cornell Box, which is this famous computer graphics, you know, sort of cool little test scene, appeared. You know, that it's funny, Don Greenberg, the guy who ran the lab, told us, you know, well, told our group basically, go make a box and paint a side, you know, red and paint the other side blue. And they're like, what? And, you know, they came back a week later and saying, he's like, well, where's my box? And they're like, you mean you wanted to make this real box, you know? So, you know, it was just that kind of like, but I love that idea of like, okay, well, can we make something real, and can we actually really simulate it in the virtual world? And I'm still doing that today. I mean, I've been sort of going back and forth with people about, well, can we just get a cheap light meter and, you know, and like a light bulb and just calculate exactly what we should be getting. And how is our physically based rendering actually comparing to that? You know, it's very simple experiments, probably done all the time in the lab. But, you know, now for like, you know, $50 on Amazon, you can buy all the equipment you need, which, you know, two decades ago, it might be $100,000 to get that equipment. And you know, that's sort of another recurring theme. Like, so anyway, after Cornell, I went into my advisor basically became my president. We had a little startup called 3DI. And there I got involved in just ray tracing for Hewlett Packard. Like they were coming out with stuff for mechanical parts and so on, and they wanted to make cool pictures. And so we did ray tracing radiosity and stuff for them. At the same time, I also got involved with Andrew Glasner invited me to work on a ray tracing course for SIGGRAPH. And that evolved into the first book about ray tracing, Introduction to Ray Tracing, which you can now download for free. I'm happy to say he was able to sort of free it from the publisher, and now it's free to download. And it's still valid. I mean, math doesn't rot. That's the the fun thing about textbooks and so on, is that, you know, that math, it's not like something, you know, broke and we've all decided 2 + 2 = 5. You know, it's those are all still fine equations. But anyway, so for me, one of the amazing experiences was that, so in 1987, I was working on a bunch of little databases, like little procedural kinds of things, like, oh, you know, here, let's just have a bunch of spheres that are kind of in a sort of fractally pattern, and I called that one SphereFlake. That had the cool name, but just a bunch of these sort of test pattern kind of things, because I wanted to test ray tracers. You know, we're trying to sort of compare and go, well, what's a good algorithm? What's the fastest way to do this, that, or the other? And so I posted that code to what was before web browsers and so on, you know, this thing called Usenet. I just posted the code about 3 weeks before SIGGRAPH, and I thought nothing more of it. I'm like, you know, maybe someone will use it. And then I went to SIGGRAPH, and on the show floor, AT&T Pixel Machines had implemented, had actually taken my code and made it happen. And it was a revelation. They had this $150,000 machine that basically could ray trace this thing that the SphereFlake image, which was just like, you know, 8,000 spheres, reflective spheres with three lights, nothing too complicated by today's standards. But back then it took me 2 hours on a good expensive workstation to render that image. Now they're doing it in, you know, 30 seconds. And it was also the first interactive ray tracer. You move a mouse around, you move this little shiny sphere on a plane, and it would reflect it then, like, you know, 3 frames per second or something. Anyway, so that to me was just, you know, like, okay, you know, with enough hardware, you can make this thing go, and it's just a matter of time. And so now we're kind of here. I mean, really, in the past 5 years, you know, like NVIDIA's introduced ray tracing hardware. And that part of their GPU, just an extra thing on the GPU. You know, AMD's following suit. Intel placed, you know, Sony. A lot of vendors are basically going, yeah, how can we do this? This is cool. What's it all about?
Absolutely. Look, so much exciting stuff that you're sharing. And I love that, you know, you had sharing in your DNA from the beginning of your time in graphics and computing. And I think it's people like you that have made the whole community, you know, very, very collaborative. I love all the tie-ins with SIGGRAPH. I think, you know, this podcast actually started from the Building the Open Metaverse BOF at SIGGRAPH last year. And we had so much to talk about. We started this podcast and, you know, the story of 1982, looking at the back of that SIGGRAPH journal, I think is really cool. So Eric, I'd love just, you know, what does the metaverse mean to you?
Yeah, so, right. I mean, that's one of those things, right? Where it's like, well, what does it mean? And excuse me. And what it means to me is, well, it can mean a lot of things, really. One can just simply be like NVIDIA, they're interested in the metaverse is things like digital twins, where you say, okay, I'm going to make, you know, a warehouse, and I'll be able to simulate that warehouse as fully as possible, and I can train robots on it or whatever. And I can basically simulate things so that I'll know if, you know, if it's dangerous to workers or, you know, anything like that. And certainly I've left out bits of my history, but for 20 years I worked at Autodesk, and one of their ideas was with Revit is to have this sort of living version of the building. You know, it's like, well, you built the building and there's, you know, but an architect's plans are not necessarily how the building actually gets built in the field. And so you sort of have it as built. But you also want to try to, if you can, record that data. Like you can, you know, sort of say, oh, well, we did this slightly different thing here for, you know, whatever reason. Okay, well, now you know that. That's part of the living building plan. And you can actually then use that living building to do other things like maintenance or just, you know, paying attention to a lot of different, like, or just knowing what's behind a wall. You know, I mean, a lot of times you'll just have, you know, a plan of something from who knows when. You know, I live in a 120-30-year-old house. I don't know what's behind most of the walls, and it's usually a revelation. You know, you take off some shingles and go, oh dear, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money. You know, so having that kind of living building thing, knowing like, well, when was the insulation put in, and when, you know, where were things done? So that kind of thing where sort of the virtual and the real overlap, I think, is a really interesting space. You know, there's also sort of the metaverse of just games, you know, of, we've certainly seen like, you know, Fortnite or, you know, World of Warcraft, MMOs kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned Minecraft, and that one was to me really addictive because it was permanent in the sense that, you know, you would do something in that world and that changed the world. It wasn't like World of Warcraft, where World of Warcraft, oh, I just killed the cool monster. Oh, don't worry, in 15 minutes, he'll be back. You know, and you've basically made no physical changes, you know, or virtual changes in that world, right? So I think that changing things in the virtual world thing is significant. You know, it's nice to have the, well, we went to the cool, music event or whatever, or the party, and we met up, and that's fine to have the social spaces and so on. But I think that virtual thing where you're actually building, you know, something and that it has some kind of permanence in a sense. There's really something strong about that. There's something really compelling about that. I admit it, I'm doing it tonight. I'm meeting up with my two sons, and we're going to Valheim. and it's fun. You know, you're sort of building things, and you're exploring, and you're just doing it together. And that, to me, that's, you know, that's a small bit of the virtual world. It's very compelling kind of an experience for that reason. Anyway. So let's see what else. I don't know. Just, yeah, mapping in general. I mean, just seeing things like, I was thinking about it today. I was walking around, and one of my things I do is I try to take a walk every day. And so My summer project last summer was, I'm going to go and map, or I'm going to help confirm the map of all the little free libraries and micro pantry food fridges and stuff in the area. Where I live, Somerville is like the most densely populated city in all of New England, denser than Boston. And it's mostly because of a shortage of green space, frankly, but it's next to Cambridge, it's next to Boston, and so on. And so this area, there's just a high density of things going on. So in the area, there's 200 little free libraries. Well, why don't I map them? And why don't I stick a little QR code in the window of each one so that anybody can just take their phone out and go, okay, show me the map. And, oh, look, there's three others that are two blocks away that I never knew about. And so it's just this very simple thing where it's like, by just doing, it's just me and a bunch of volunteers basically reporting where locations are. And we put it into a map, and now suddenly people can go find stuff, find where they can donate their extra canned goods to help someone else out, donate their books and let someone else enjoy them and so on. And it's a very minor thing in a certain kind of way. It's very like low-level tech in a certain way, but it's not something we could have done a decade ago. There wasn't really the ability to do Google Maps and like edit your own map and share that map with people. And QR codes, that wasn't really a thing that you could just get a free QR code. I think there's just sort of things that are sort of subtly happening that we don't, like, for me, the metaverse, the ultimate is like the holodeck, right? As we all think, Star Trek holodeck, we're all going to have these adventures in some, crazy space or something. And it's like, well, yeah, you could do that. But there's also just sort of this percolating, data is everywhere kind of thing. It's just hiding behind the surface. It's just, you have to pick up your phone and kind of look for that data, but it's right there. If in some cases it's very close. Another wonderful example is like Google Translate. I mean, I hope that everyone knows that if you, put Google Translate, an app on your phone, and you hold it up to a sign that's in a foreign language, it'll translate it for you in about the same font, about the same size and everything. And you just hold it there and you can read that sign. And that's just miraculous to me. I mean, that's like, that's basically like this sort of unseen information that the sort of virtual impinges on the real. And it's so cool.
So one thing we were hoping to cover today was thinking about the cumulative work of graphics, of the SIGGRAPH community, of folks in games, movies, manufacturing, and how their work has really created the foundations for the metaverse, what it is today and what it can be in the future. And you've already touched on so many things. You talked about kind of ray tracing and its evolution, and then all the advancements here in digital twins for construction and for mapping, and then talking about in that game environment, users being able to build and manipulate objects, really lowering the barrier to entry for creators. Were there any other kind of cumulative work that you wanted to talk about?
Well, certainly graphics in general, for sure, of course. It's just, we've gone from very simple, scenes to things like Unreal's Nanite technology is just incredible. Like huge amounts of detail that you can get. The compute power is not to be denied. I work for NVIDIA now, and so the bragging rights is that like 7 out of the 10 fastest supercomputers have GPUs as their basis. Well, GPUs wouldn't have been around if there wasn't a consumer market that was in the mid 90s with 3DFX and then NVIDIA and AMD or ATI at the time, coming out with consumer level graphics cards that brought the prices way down. So it's interesting how the consumer markets actually made it possible for all the other cool things to happen, we're doing digital twins of, the entire world's climate, so we can kind of see the effects of climate change and so on. But it's due to the sort of falling prices of games and so on, of consumer uses. So just seeing that, that's sort of a fascinating thing. And like I say, my specialty is ray tracing. I've done it for lots and lots of years. And I've tried to encourage community by like the ray tracing news, which is one thing that Andrew Glasner, and shout out to him, he's founded actually as a paper thing. And then I said, this could go on to, this could just be an email or a Usenet thing. Anyway, that ability to just share information now is just, it's just crazy great. And, also just seeing things like, one thing I did get to help do was help found a, the Journal of Graphics Tools, which led to the Journal of Computer Graphics Techniques, which are absolutely free journals, basically, or the second one, JCGT, is, you know, it's all online, it's free. I just, you know, been shepherding a paper today, which, you know, we sent off the reviews to the authors. We expect the authors to get back to us in a few weeks. And after it goes through copy editing, boom, it's on, you know, it's available. And so you can still have a high quality kind of a thing where you have a high quality journal, but you don't have to have the 6 month lag time. And you also don't have to have the, oh, I just threw the, you know, I just threw it onto, I threw my article onto, you know, some PLOS or onto some, you know, free thing, which is, you know, I think there's still an editorial function in journals, for example. They don't necessarily have to be printed, but that editorial review, that peer review is really important, I think, for trying to sort of separate out the, you know, good information from the bad. And also just to help the author to, you know, refine their work and make it worth people's time. I mean, you know, there's only so much time you can, you only have so much time to read articles. So you want to sort of go to the places that have, you feel are higher quality. And so it's just exciting to see that, you know, that evolution has occurred where, well, we really don't need the print. We really don't need the, you know, the big publisher with lots of paper and a printing press off in Pennsylvania or whatever. You know, we can do it for essentially free. You know, it's, you know, it's Patreon at worst. You know, you just need really a few bucks for a copy editor and that's it, you know? So, I mean, that's what's exciting is just how much a single individual can make a huge difference nowadays, as opposed to, you know, it used to be just hundreds of people in a company to do something. You know, now you're seeing it all the time where one person comes up with a great little thing and, you know, changes the world.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of JCGT, and I love the philosophy of doing very pragmatic work and having it so available. And I agree with you that one person can really make a big impact. So when you look at the progress of the field, do you think that the second derivative is also increasing, that we're making more progress and making it faster?
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I went to a talk virtual with MIT CSAIL last week, and a week or two ago. And it was pretty interesting. The guy, his name's eluding me, but basically he sort of tracks algorithms. He and his group are trying to sort of look at all the algorithms and look at algorithmic progress and about, you know, you might go from like an N squared, like, you know, I won't get into the technical details, but from a difficult, you know, like a not very good algorithm to a better algorithm to a better algorithm. And he was kind of maintaining that it's kind of running out of steam on some algorithms, like a lot of sort of major kinds of algorithmic problems, like classic problems, that, you know, well, we've kind of solved those big ones. And on one level, I was like, yeah, that's true. You know, there's sort of a theoretical minimum that you can get to. But on the other hand, you know, there's always new hardware. There's always new ways of data, you know, what's important. I mean, like, for example, I think it just sums up as there's always a bottleneck, and that bottleneck changes. Like, you know, it used to be back in the 80s, we would do instruction counts. Like we'd go, oh, look, you know, we want to multiply 3 times 5 plus 6. Okay, well, that's a multiply and an add. Okay, that's 2 instructions. That's really important. Okay, well, that became irrelevant, you know, 20 years later, where we basically said, no, what's more important is how memory is, you know, what, like touching memory is slow. You know, the memory is sort of this big pool of stuff you can use, but it's sometimes slow to get that memory. So that's the bottleneck. But then as you think about things like the metaverse or trying, you know, Internet of Things and so on, you go, well, maybe it's the bandwidth, you know, or maybe it's latency, like it's the round trip, you know, it's like I get an information in, my headset responds, and then I respond to that information. There's some latency, some lag there. You know, is that the important thing? And how do we cut that lag down? You know, maybe 5G, you know, will actually change that kind of bottleneck, because 5G is supposed to be, you know, much, much faster, right? And so it'll be really interesting. I'm excited actually to see 5G hopefully really permeate and really become just like the common, like the norm. You know, I'm hoping that people will go through at least one more upgrade cycle on their cell phones. You know, that the cell phone market's kind of slowing down. And I think that's part of the reason we're interested in the metaverse, is because it's like, you know, commercially, it's like, ooh, what's the next hot thing? But, you know, just seeing how, you know, just amazing the phone has become, you know, but I think there's still even more there. So yeah, you know, there's sort of this, oh, in theory, we've slowed down, but in a lot of ways, we've really sped up as far as like going, oh, look, you know, we can just make, you know, these processors are cheaper. We're literally putting, oh, I forget what they call it. I think it's like the, I'm going to try to get the term right. Let's see. I'm going to look at it. It's the SuperPod is the marketing term. There's this thing where they basically hook together a whole bunch of these sort of GPU-based processors in a huge system. You get like, you know, a terabyte of memory. You get petaflops of processing and so on. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that we look at now and we go, oh, that's the, boy, that thing's like the price of, you know, that's millions of dollars. But you go, well, again, I look at the Pixel machine 35 years ago, that was $150,000. My cell phone is way more powerful than the Pixel machine is now. So, you know, I can't keep promising Moore's Law is going to continue and so on, but, you know, there's a lot of just, there's so much interesting stuff happening in this area that, I mean, that's what's great about the field, right? Every 5 years, there's a new technology and you go, oh, what's that mean? Anyway.
You know, I think like it would have been very cool to be around in the 70s when the field was really unfolding. But I'm really happy to be in the field today because we have so much compute available, so much work that's already been done. I think it's just, it's so exciting. So previously you mentioned that you're working on ray tracing and that you're working at NVIDIA. You want to tell us more about what you're up to at NVIDIA?
Yeah, a few things. Let's see. I mean, one thing is this Omniverse project, which you guys have already had a whole session on, or so I won't go into it too deeply, except to say Omniverse. What Omniverse means to me is it's basically a way to pull in data from different sources and be able to do cool things with it, like simulations and so on. I'm more focused on the rendering side of things, and really, I'm kind of a very glorified quality assurance person right now. Like I'll try out the keyframer, or I'll try out this, you know, various rendering things, and I'll be able to give hopefully very informed bug reports about, hey, this is wrong, and I think it's because your normal maps are maybe reversed, and you're not doing the proper blah 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 or whatever. You know that. So I'm not programming so much per se, but I'm trying to look carefully that we're getting it all right. And so really lately my interest has been a kind of obscure thing in a way. It's something that we all think we know about, but I realized I've been in the field, I don't know, 40 odd years or something. And I'm like, yeah, no, I really don't know that area that well, which is describing light. Like what, you know, we talk about, oh, physically based light, like, you know, we talk about, well, we have a light source and it's giving off photons. And of course, to you and me, photons means visible light, but photons can mean anything. They can mean microwaves or X-rays or whatever, you know, and they bounce off some surface. And so we know a lot about surface material kinds of things where we go, oh, it's metallic and it's this shiny, you know, this kind of glossiness that has this kind of response and so on. And we know about lights. I mean, lights, you know, actually measuring lights has been around for 120 plus years of how many lumens or candelas or whatever. But it's not something we pay a heck of a lot of attention to in most packages. It's kind of interesting. We just kind of go, oh, the lights are dim. Well, make them brighter, you know, turn the knob. You know, I know NVIDIA is definitely working on it with other people. They've got, you know, sort of a serious group that's working on getting that just right for simulation, because you want to be able to take real world data and bring it into, you know, your simulated environment and have it respond properly to the right lighting. And you can actually set the, you know, you can say, well, the sun's, you know, 100,000 lux, and that'll actually work properly inside your application. And it sounds like sort of trivial, like, oh, you know, you just set the light to be properly correct. But I've been doing a sort of a survey of the field, and there's not that many apps that are really sort of generally doing that kind of thing, or doing it well, doing it nicely. So anyway, that's my own personal sort of rabbit hole, but it's been a very interesting rabbit hole. I mean, this weekend I may be going into literally a rabbit hole. I may be going into my closet and putting a blanket over my head and holding up a 60 watt, you know, whatever that is. I forget how many lumens light bulb that is, and putting a little gray card on the floor and getting my fancy, you know, $8 app on my iPhone so I can set the exposure just right and seeing if I can run the numbers and get, you know, get the right answer. Like, you know, is this really working as I should expect it to? And it all sounds minor, but I mean, I've been talking with other people, like a games company, for example. They're doing the same kinds of things. Like, they're going out and going, yeah, we're just, you know, buying some cheap equipment. You know, you can get your Lux meter for $20 off of Amazon, and you know, just trying to cobble something together in the garage to, like, go, well, is our game kind of responding the right way to light? And, you know, what are we missing here if we're not, you know, if we don't do it right? So it sounds like a very silly niche in a way, but it's one where I realized I don't really know much about that area. So I've spent the past few months kind of in my spare time kind of reading about that. And it's been fun to read about. But, you know, it's just one element that it's like, oh, it sounds minor, but, you know, getting it right makes it just much easier for us to interchange data. Speaking of which, I want to talk about USD a little bit, because that's the other thing I've actually been working a lot on in the past 2 years or so, is just trying to get USD, or trying to understand USD, for one, just what its materials and what its lights and so on and camera model is, and just testing it. Like I say, I had, you know, like you mentioned, I got seriously addicted to Minecraft back in, you know, 2012 or whatever. And, you know, I went through the 12 steps program. I'm clean now. I don't, I don't have my Minecraft addiction anymore. But what did come out of that was I wrote this little program, free program called Mineways, which just lets you export data from Minecraft to, you know, to a common file format. And I started with this ancient one called Wavefront OBJ from like the 80s, but it's still used today. And so, you know, sort of like with USD coming up, I'm like, ooh, I should export to USD because it's a much more full-featured format. I mean, you know, it's actually kind of pitiful that we're, you know, one of our formats that we're using nowadays, and I still see it used all the time, is OBJ, you know, from the 80s, you know. And so I'm very happy about, like, seeing you and others using GLTF and pushing GLTF, because it's like, oh yeah, we need a new interactive format that's just better. And, you know, so it's been great seeing GLTF really come into its own. And I consider it sort of GLTF kind of like the, in some ways, the big brother to Pixar's USD, in that, you know, I think USD can learn things from GLTF as far as just some of the definitional stuff that you guys are working on, that you're a few steps ahead on a few things. And I've heard that in your podcast, where, you know, the USD people are like, yeah, we like GLTF and, you know, we like their ideas and so on. So that's great to see. Anyway, but for me anyway, the fidelity has been a really important thing. Is like, just Omniverse is supposed to be, well, we're taking in data from, you know, all kinds of different apps. Well, if, you know, if that common material format, if I'm pulling it in from one app and it looks different than when I'm pulling it from another app, and they say that they want to be the same, but they look different, it's broken as far as I'm concerned. So so I've been using my little Mineways exporter to test USD. So it's like, you know, the geometry I don't care about. It's all just blocks. Minecraft's all blocks and cutout objects, and that's it. But it can get very elaborate. Like, the hobbyists out there have gone nuts, and you can get very elaborate, you know, metallic with normal maps and reflectance and all this kind of crazy stuff attached to these models. So I've been doing a lot of just putting out that data, seeing where I've gone wrong, fixing it, whatever. But also, it's just been great for testing both Omniverse and a bunch of apps, you know, a bunch of popular digital content creation apps out there, and just finding out, ooh, you know, this isn't so good. We gotta get a little more standardization here. I saw that, you know, one thing I wanted to mention was many years ago, I worked on VRML a bit, which is sort of a precursor, sort of yet another file format in a way, but it was supposed to be sort of the harbinger of, like, oh, we're going to use this for VR, and this is going to be the metaverse and all the rest, right? And it never really caught on, and I think for a few reasons. Like, VRML1 was really solid. VRML2 was solid, but no, it was kind of a write-only language, because they added all these sensors and simulation kinds of things, like time sensors and proximity sensors and touch sensors and stuff. And it soon became unreadable, like, you know, by anybody other than the person producing the file. And so, you know, that's, I think, one of the dangers that that you guys face and that USD faces and so on is, you know, it's easy to extend things, but you kind of have to make sure there's buy-in and that it doesn't evolve so quickly, like something doesn't get standardized that people are like, yeah, that's part of the standard, but I don't implement that, you know, and that's a problem. If it's not getting implemented by the majority of users, or by the majority of implementers, you know, then you're really in trouble. Anyway, that's my cautionary tale, because VRML pretty much died. I mean, you still see it used for 3D printing, actually, oddly enough, but not much else, as far as I know. But back in the day, we were like, oh, it's going to be great. And it was. It was actually really a beautiful effort, but for various reasons, it wasn't quite there.
A lot of good stuff. So I think the USD GLTF admiration, I think, is mutual. I think there's a lot that GLTF can learn from USD, and I hope that, you know, both evolve in the future in a way that maybe there's some transcoding in both directions. The challenges that you mentioned around consistency for physically based rendering materials or any materials, that's a tough problem. Yeah, I know Kronos looked at it with Collada kind of way back in the day. We certainly looked at it with GLTF, and they may still be looking at it. I feel good knowing that minds like yours are looking at it. I can't wait to see kind of what you come up with. And then finally, you know, that kind of lesson learned on extending VRML from 1.0 to 2.0, certainly with GLTF, and we were very careful trying to do a minimal but useful set for efficient 3D runtime asset, allow folks to extend it, but try to extend, you know, at a reasonable pace so that you can get adoption and then still have a robust interoperability. So that's a tightrope that is, you know, a challenge to walk.
Yep, for sure. I mean, yeah, but, you know, a necessary element. I mean, it is great to see that we've gotten a lot closer than we used to be, kind of thing, as far as being able to interop. You know, we always want to do one more thing. Oh, I just want to add one more feature and so on. But I appreciate the paces, you know, really trying to think that through carefully. Because once you've sort of added some crazy thing, it's hard to pull it back, you know, and you know, not be able to do it anymore. I mean, like the 3GS guys can do that, like, because that's just a hobby project. And that's a project that I love. It's just this thing. Oh, you know, 3GS, it's a great way to just learn about graphics. It sort of hides all this sort of WebGL complication. You know, you can just sort of say, I want a sphere and I want a camera and I want to, put a light over here. And, you know, in a few minutes, you can get something on the screen in your web browser. You can send that link to somebody and share it and so on. But those guys are, pretty wild as far as, like, you know, standards is like, it's the opposite. They'll just go, I don't like that feature. I'm throwing it away, and now we're doing some other feature. And, you know, and it's like I say, it's a great area to learn in and so on and play with still, but it's a little bit tricky if you're trying to have any kind of, you know, continuity of software and being able to keep your software running on that platform. You pretty much have to lock into place and say, oh, I can't move from here. I am, you know, I'm stuck. But anyway.
And you reminded me of an interesting story from a Kronos BOF at SIGGRAPH, and you were there. It was the BOF when Amanda Watson from Oculus came up and talked about their use of GLTF. And after that, Ton from Blender, he and I were chatting, and he gave me perhaps the best advice I ever got for GLTF, which was keep GLTF simple, get it to 1.0, have a lot of folks adopt it, and then you can add to it slowly. He's like, don't put everything in right away.
Thank you. You got the message.
Man, you know. So, very influential. So, Eric, the next question I've been waiting to ask you. So, look, yeah, I want to ask you how folks can get into the field, into graphics, into the metaverse. And, look, I really believe that there's, like, no one else better in the world to ask than you. And certainly, you know, when I think of myself, I mean, you helped me get into the field. And I did a little research before this podcast, and I went back into my old Hotmail email, and I found the email when we first met. It was January 2010. And I sent you an email, and, you know, you didn't know me. And I said, Eric, you know, love your books. You know, I did this master's thesis, this cool 3D globe stuff. I'm going to write this book. Can you give me some advice? Will you be at i3D? And that same day, you didn't know me, you replied and you said, I won't be at I3D. Here's some advice and here's my phone number. Wow. I mean, look how welcoming, you know, the graphics community was, and that, you know, you really helped me a lot over the years in many facets, not just the book. So I would love, you know, for our listeners, whether they're, you know, they're in college, maybe they're in high school, or maybe they're in a, you know, in another field, or maybe they're in graphics, but they want to do something else in the metaverse. I mean, what advice do you have for us?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's plenty of ways to get involved. I mean, that's the beauty of the field right now. It's just, you know, the fact that there's this whole internet out there that you can do things like look at, you know, Babylon.js or 3.js, and, you know, you can learn, you know, there's bunches of tutorials out there. I mean, I taught a MOOC about this, you know, 8 or 9 years ago. So that one's old, so don't use that. I mean, you know, there's some good material there, but like I say, 3.js has kind of moved on and done other stuff. But honestly, I mean, just looking at those kinds of packages, if you're interested in programming, or even if you're just interested in, like, I just want to play with some objects and put some stuff on the screen and, you know, send you know, my grandparents a link and they can look at this cool thing that I did. That's, you know, that's all to the good. You know, it's very easy to sort of just jump into some of those packages. And it's, you know, you just have to kind of follow the steps carefully. Like, okay, wow, oh, I can now, you know, I just use my text editor and I change the sign. And what happened to the light? Oh, ooh, okay, it changed it like that. Cool. Okay, what if I change the, you know, the shininess of that sphere? Oh, okay, that's what that does. And by just experimenting, you can sort of quickly get some really good, you know, solid, honestly, graphics knowledge from just your own experimentation, if you want to do it that way. But there's also, you know, projects to get involved in. I mean, you know, there's tons, like there's people that are writing mods. So if you're, you know, more artistically, inclined, you can kind of just get involved in the modding scene of, you know, okay, well, you know, I want to come with some textures, or I want to, you know, do a, you know, I'll make a model for this thing in Blender, or I want to do some animation or whatever. And that can just, again, it's sort of one of those, you choose, you know, it's like choose your own adventure. You know, you go, oh, wait, I want to know about animation. Well, oh, okay, well, Blender, yeah, that's free, you know, so, and you can find a ton of stuff on YouTube and all over the place about, you know, how to do this, that, and the other in Blender. So that's, you know, that's a great venue. You know, traditional ways, obviously, go to school, you know, having a solid education, you know, some kind of, you know, either in the arts or computer science or a mix of both, really is, that's, you know, the double threat kind of thing, is to have really both, you know, is if you can, you know something about modeling and art and how perspective works and all that kind of stuff, you know, that can also, that has a direct connection to graphics for sure. So yeah, there's, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting ways there. What are the things? Also, yeah, you know, like papers are accessible. I mean, you know, some of these papers, yeah, they're probably going to go over your head. There's good blogs out there. You can look for those. You know, I'll put a plug in for realtimerendering.com. There's a page which I which I call the portal page, which I have left at that because that was the name we, you know, people used 20 years ago. And I always kind of cracked me up to hear this portal page, but that's just sort of a page of resources, and it has a bunch of blogs listed that I think are pretty good. And so that's, you know, a great resource to just go and dig into that page and look at stuff there. What else? Like, yeah, like I say, read articles, or if you see someone that, you know, hey, what, you know, you're doing something cool, write them, you know, you know, don't feel shy. I mean, that's something that really impressed me about you, to be honest, you know, Patrick, is that you weren't shy. You were like, oh, there's this guy, I'd like to meet him. Well, I think I'll go try to write him and see what happens, you know? And that's one thing, I think you've heard me say it before, but is like, if you want to contact someone on LinkedIn, like you want to make a connection on LinkedIn, don't just hit the button that says make a connection on LinkedIn. Cause, most people will either, they'll just accept it like, yeah, I don't care, or they'll go, I don't know who you are, and they'll refuse it. But if you actually write them and say, well, I read your article, you know, it was really interesting, but I didn't really understand this part, or, oh, I wanted to talk to you about that or whatever. That's something I'll respond to. I mean, that's something that, you know, if you see, you know, that, oh, wow, this person's putting in more than the 2 seconds that it took them to click that connect on LinkedIn button, that means something. You know, people like to know that their work's getting used. You know, if you've written a book or an article or whatever, and someone writes to you and says, oh, I have a question about this, you know, I'll try to find the time to respond, because that's, you know, that you're that 1 in 1,000 who's actually making the effort, you know, interested in the topic. And I want to encourage that. So that's where I tend to go.
That's such good advice. And once in a while, people do email Kevin or I about the 3D engine design for Virtual Globes book, you know, 11 years later. And we really do make an attempt, you know, to give a useful, some type of useful response. So I think that's great advice. And then, you know, you encouraging folks that the barrier to entry to get started with a 3GS or Babylon is so low is great, right? You can jump in and experiment. And then the fact that you can contribute and build either on the technical engineering side or on the art side, right? I think there's, you know, many, many ways to play. So that's awesome. So Eric, we've talked about so much. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to?
I could blab on this stuff for hours, but no, not particularly. I mean, I think, you know, there, like I say, I think that's, it's just interesting to sort of see, you know, like, well, you're in the sort of GIS field and it's just fascinating to sort of see, like I say, that sort of permeability or something between, you know, sort of virtual and the real world. Like, you know, I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing it in things like Ukraine and so on, where, you know, open source intelligence, you know, the Bellingcat people and so on, you know, they're trying to figure out things. But I think there's just, you know, like just open source mapping or, you know, it's fascinating. And I think we'll kind of go like in 20 years, like, you know, wow, you know, they didn't wear cameras back then that kind of just mapped their whole area and, you know, detected potholes or detected, you know, like that's just the norm now. You know, you have like this, these sensors that, you know, are picking up data. Right now we're sort of individually smart sensors. You know, we can go like for example, in Somerville, we have this 311 app, and we were the first ones in the state, and now a bunch of places have it, which is, you know, you basically have an app where you're standing somewhere and you're like, there's a pothole right here. And it's, you know, you bring it up, you say, there's a pothole right here. And, you know, and it'll obviously, because of GPS, it'll know where it is and all that. And within a week, it'll get fixed, you know, which is really miraculous if you think about it, because that's something, you know, you really had to have a big effort to like tell where a pothole was, you know, 10 years ago. And I think it's going to be the same as we go. It's like, you know, there's sort of the, to me, a little bit, you know, scary nanny state kind of thing where we're putting cameras on all the corners. But, you know, I think that can happen in different ways. I mean, we're already sort of seeing that with people with their cell phones, you know, explicitly photographing things. But I think that you can also have sort of an implicit, like, you know, you are sensing something about you and you're willing to share that data. And I think that's just huge. You know, that will just continue. And we're going to just see a lot of interesting things going on there. Anyway, that's my only other kind of obvious thing that, you know, many people have said, but it's you just see it coming. You know, that's, I think there's just a lot of interesting ideas coming out about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's accumulation of so much technology, right? It's so many different types of sensors. They're widely available. There's more bandwidth. There's more compute. The appetite for digital 3D content. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, even in the next year, I'm looking forward to, I guess, Snap with Snapchat. They're having some spectacles come out for AR, you know, and Apple's rumored to have something next year, maybe next spring or something. So we'll see. But yeah, no, it's just, you know, I don't know what it'll be that triggers things. You know, as much as I love the Oculus Quest 2, it's kind of a big, heavy, bulky thing. You know, it's not what we all dream of, which is the lightweight glasses that we can maybe tap and do something with, or, you know, but there's other things going on. I mean, like technology of just being able to talk to your sort of smart speakers. Alexa, you know, I ask it for the weather. I put a timer on. Maybe that's not it. But, you know, walking around, it'd be like, okay, wait, I want to talk and sort of, you know, immediately get some kind of response. Yeah, I can imagine that happening on a different form factor. But anyway, it's exciting to think about, but not my area of expertise. So hopefully the people listening to this are the guys who are, you know, you're all doing this cool stuff and making it happen. So go for it. Great.
Eric, we like to wrap up the show with a shout out. Is there any person or organization you want to give a shout out to?
I do. I was thinking about this, and it's kind of a silly one in a way because it's sort of very old school, but I think it's really critical, which is archive.org, which is just, you know, kind of the, you know, where all the old dead web pages can be found because people will have a cool blog or cool articles or whatever, but they're not, you know, they're not published or they're not, you know, formally put into some archive. And so archive.org is great. I mean, Wikipedia depends on it, really. If you see a lot of their, you know, if you kind of click on a footnote, they'll often just go right to the, you know, archive.org thing because they know that'll be there, as opposed to, you know, some web link that, you know, the webmaster rearranges the website. And even if the website's still there, the link's dead. So, you know, so that you know, they do good things. I just contributed some money to them. So I recommend you all, you know, give them a few bucks if you can, because it's just a huge, huge deal.
Excellent shout out. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks everyone for listening. We really appreciate it. If you have any comments, please leave a note. Give it a thumbs up. Give it a thumbs down. Let us know what you think. And please subscribe. Thanks, everybody.